From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, crossing the event horizon. Get ready for that. Before we get going, gotta wish my mother a happy birthday. Mom, 85 years old, going strong. Happy birthday. Another 50 people have suffered salmonella poisoning linked to Foster Farms chicken. Now, that brings the total to 574 cases just in the United States since March of 2013. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said in an update that the new cases were reported at an average of 8 a week since April, since a report on new infections caused by strains of the drug-resistant salmonella. 37% of those with the foodborne activity and bacteria have been hospitalized in the outbreak that began again 2013. 13% have developed blood infections, three times the number in typical salmonella infections. Let's check in with food safety coach Jeff Nelkin. Of course, Jeff, you've always advised us, cook your chicken. But in this particular case, what else is going on? You're going to have to punch it
into at least 165 degrees, which means we have to have a thermometer. Every time you hear about a problem like this, it tells you something went wrong in the preparation, in the sanitation, that people wash their hands, their work surfaces. That's what we need to focus on, making sure that people understand that you've got to cook chicken to 165. Otherwise, that salmonella will survive.
Now, Jeff, in this particular case, I would assume then that these 574 people poorly cooked the chicken.
That's a very fair assumption.
All right. So it's simple as that. As horrible as this bacteria sounds, folks, cook it. Jeff, thanks so much.
The thermometer to verify that you've reached that 165.
All right. You got that right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff Nelkin, food safety coach. The widespread use of antibiotics on farms without medical supervision has been condemned at a meeting of the World Organization for Animal Health. There are particular concerns in the U.S., where authorities say it contributes significantly to resistance. It's estimated that 80% of the antibiotics purchased in the U.S. are used on farm animals. The large-scale use has prompted concerns that microbes will develop resistance as well. An Oklahoma man has died after acquiring the Heartland virus, making him the second person in the U.S. to die after coming down with that illness. It's like MERS. Hackers have exposed the personal information of 110 million Americans. That's roughly half of the nation's adults in the last 12 months alone. The massive number is made even more mind-boggling by the amount of hacked accounts, 432 million. Can you believe that? Google is starting to build its own self-driving cars rather than modifying vehicles built by other manufacturers. Now, get this. The car will have a stop-and-go button, no controls, no steering wheel, no pedals. Man, I'm not sure I'd want to drive a car like that. Let's check in with Howard Bloom. He, of course, is an expert on life. Howard, would you drive one of these?
I would love to drive in one of these. I just came back from 2 weeks out in L.A. The Keck Institute of Space Studies at Caltech flew me out there for 2 weeks of brainstorming sessions. And in L.A., you can be stuck between meetings for an hour and 15 minutes in traffic. And what you really want to do is not sit there at your car wheel fuming. You want to be getting some work done. You want to be preparing for the meeting you're about to go into, look over the research materials, and make sure you've absolutely finished the presentation you're about to show. You can do that if the car is driving you. Up until now, the luxury of having somebody who would drive you intelligently so you could concentrate on texting or calling people or whatever you really enjoyed the most, even if it's watching a movie, that was a luxury for only very rich people who could afford a limousine and a driver. Now with this car, you will have a limousine and a driver.
How can you trust this kind of a car, though, Howard? My gosh.
It has safety stuff built into it that is utterly beyond belief. It has sensors that reach out over the distance of two football fields. It has two braking systems so that if one fails, the other kicks in. It has two motors so that if one fails, the other kicks in. and it'll keep the right distance from the car ahead of you, the car behind you. It'll be very, it is very aware of its surroundings. It works with something that's the equivalent of Google Maps, but much more detailed. So it knows the surroundings you're about to enter. It knows the road. It even knows the height of the curbs on the road. Those things it has in easy memory. But in current memory, it's able to keep track of a bicycle driver who's putting his hand out to make a turn. It's able to keep track of a pedestrian who's jaywalking. So, and it's built, it is built with all kinds of soft stuff. So you don't have the steering wheel impaling you the way that you do in an accident in an ordinary car. It's all, it's foam and easy plastics, but it's built to be, to keep away from accidents and to perceive the potential of an accident before the accident can happen.
I was going to say, can it take evasive maneuvers?
It apparently can take evasive maneuvers. And more than that, it's plugged into, you know how Google has this new service, Google Now, that tries to keep track of your daily patterns so it knows when you're going to a meeting and it knows all the things that you're going to need before you go and it gives you a map of how to get there. Well, that Google Now intelligence that tries to adapt itself to you is built into the car. So your car is going, it's not going to be your car anymore. These are built to provide a new form of public transportation. So you want to go out of the house, you want to go into town, you simply hit a button on your cell phone, on your smartphone, and the car shows up and it's there by the time you get down the stairs. It's according to some technical publications, it could put Uber and Lyft, those real high-tech services that are just coming online in many cities that'll get you the equivalent of a cab almost instantly. It'll put them out of business because it'll be there faster. It'll be there more conveniently. It'll be more aware of you.
One more question here, Howard. What about the drunk driver? What about the person who is inebriated, leaves the bar, gets into his self-driving automobile? He's technically responsible for it, but he's not driving.
Well, he's not driving, and he's going to be driven home safely. And this is for Sergey Brin, one of the founders of
Google,
who introduced this car 2 days ago, says those people who've hit their 80s and have shrunken too much to drive and you don't really trust them on the road, they don't have to worry about mobility anymore because they simply step into this thing and it drives them where they need to go. And it reminds you, if you wanted to make chicken hacienda for dinner but you forgot to buy chicken, it tells you there's a place that has a special on chicken up here. It'll take you directly to the place. While you're buying the chicken, it will text home to say that you will be 8 minutes late because you just stopped for chicken.
Amazing. Howard, thanks so much. Of course, you know, part of the love affair of the car is the driving. You know, you sit behind the wheel and you go out and you have a nice relaxing moment. Of course, road rage isn't pleasant. That's for sure, but this is going to change. It's going to change the face of everything we do. Again, by the way, popular literature would have it that vampires' preferred habitat is Transylvania, or if you happen to be under 15, the slightly less glamorous Forks, Washington. But modern-day vampire hunters might better focus their attention on a little-known area of northwestern Poland, where earlier this month, a suspected vampire grave was exhumed. That's right. They found skeletons, removed teeth, legs with stakes in it, all kinds of bizarre things, and they're convinced that's where those people of that era dumped vampires. Talking about strange things, the Bilderberg meeting, that's coming up, and we're going to check in a moment with the author of The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, Daniel Estulin, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me mention Daniel Estulin to you, award-winning investigative journalist, author of The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. He has given several speeches at the European Parliament on the Bilderberg Group and the international monetary crisis back in August of 2010. He was invited by Fidel Castro for a personal meeting in Havana after Castro had read Bilderberg. In October of 2010, he became the first journalist to give a speech to the Joint Chiefs of Staff of Venezuela's armed forces on the global financial structures and the Bilderberg Group. They are meeting this weekend, again, an undisclosed location, but Daniel knows where. Daniel, welcome back.
Good morning, sir. Good evening. It's great to be back on your show, as always, and the pleasure is mine.
Oh, likewise. So where are they meeting this time?
Well, But in Copenhagen in Denmark, it's an annual soiree, 3-day conference. It actually starts today, although all the members checked into the hotel, Marriott Hotel, yesterday. They're all there. It's about 125, 130 members. We have the attendance list. We have the agenda items. No real surprises this year as far as the expected points, and no real surprises as far as the attendees, although there are two Chinese members this year at the Bilderberg Conference. China, of course, is not a member of Bilderberg. Bilderberg is your former NATO alliance, Western Europe, Canada, and the United States. But still, very interestingly, you have Chinese individuals who were invited to this year's conference.
Daniel, do we know who's going at the behest of the United States and Canada?
Absolutely. We have a complete list of the attendees. Robert Zolik is going to be on the list. He is on the list. He's going to be at the meeting. He's a chairman, Board of International Advisors for Goldman Sachs. Of course, they're very well represented. Another individual is James Wolvenson, the chairman of Wolvenson & Company. Another individual is Kevin Warch. He is the fellow at Stanford University. You have Henry Kravis, one of the senior partners at KKR Investments. Peter Thiel, president of Thiel Capital, one of the investors in Facebook when it was first started. So these are some of the people from the United States. Canadians, again, the usual group. You have Heather Riesman, chairman of Indigo Books. Her uncle, Paul Riesman, was one of the negotiators for North American Free Trade Agreement way back in the 1980s and early 1990s. You have David Petraeus. He's on the list as well from KKR Global Institute. Henry Kissinger is on the list. I guess the one exception who's not on the list is David Rockefeller, but that's due to his advanced age. I'm not sure if he's 100 or 1,000 years old, but he's pretty old.
What about the politicos? Anybody going there? Hillary Clinton? Anybody like that?
We don't have her name on the list. It's quite possible she's there. We'll find out over the next 24 hours, I think. It's again, most of the people, I'd say about 99% of the individuals who are on the list are listed, for the exception of one or two, especially politicians. And it's quite possible that Hillary Clinton is there, but she just simply doesn't want to be on the official list of invitees,
right?
Because Bilderberg does have a stigma attached to it, in part thanks to my book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Book, exposing their dirty deeds. And so politicians, especially in the case of Hillary Clinton, who most likely will be contending the election, future elections for the President of the United States, she might not want to be on that list.
Daniel, new listeners all the time to Coast, explain, what is the Bilderberg Group?
In the world of international finance, George, there are those who steer the events and those who react to the events. While the latter are better known, they're greater in numbers, more celebrity status. You could say that the true power rests to the former, and in the center of this global financial system, of the financial oligarchy today represented by the Bilderberg Group. Now, Bilderberg isn't some wacky conspiracy theory. It's not some Jewish Masonic, you know, evil, all-seeing eye thing. There's no conspiracy there, although a lot of people with their infantile fantasies see it and such. It's a group of very powerful individuals who get together once a year for 3-4 days to decide on the policies which one implemented will affect the world body politics over the next 12 to 24 months. And I guess you could say that Bilderberg began back in 1954. The first meeting was held in the Netherlands at the Hotel Bilderberg, which is where the name comes from. And the hotel at the time was owned by the Dutch royal family. And Bilderberg, when it first started back in 1954, it was a very important element of the oligarchical structures of the Cold War period. And it was an important factor because it meant that it was a vehicle through which private financier oligarchical interests were able to impose their policies on what is nominally sovereign governance. So basically you had private organizations telling governments what to do. What some call One World Company Limited, corporations who want to have a lot more power than any government on the planet. And we see this all around the world. This is in a nutshell what Bilderberg is.
Daniel, you report on this, and our friend Alex Jones, of course, has been doing it for years, but not a lot of other media folks report on the Bilderberg Group. Is it because they're not aware of it, or are they afraid of it?
It's impossible not to be aware of it because key media members form part of the Bilderberg. Since 1954, Bilderberg Group has represented the elite and the absolute wealth of all Western nations. You have financiers, industrialists, bankers, politicians, business leaders of multinational corporations, presidents, prime ministers, finance ministers from Western countries. Although it's true that the sitting president of the United States never attends these meetings, he's always very well represented by others who attend on his behalf.
Right.
Although presidents or individuals who later became presidents, such as the case of Bill Clinton, they did attend the meetings, or the case of Barack Obama, for example. So it's impossible not to be aware. They know that these meetings take place because they're part of it. Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, The Economist, New York Times, Washington Post, all these individuals attend these meetings on promise that they will not report what is actually being discussed, or they will be ostracized, something that none of these individuals want because, again, it's an oligarchical clique working together towards the same objective. And needless to say, you need the world's media conglomerates as part of it because the world's elite need their agendas pushed through the world's mainstream media.
What are some of the things, Daniel, you think they talk about? I mean, are they planning the agenda for the next 5 or 10 years for the planet? Are they planning who the front runners will be for the Republican and Democratic nominations for presidency? What do they do?
It's a 3-day meeting. It takes place between Thursday and Saturday. And today, as I said, is the first day of the meeting. They have two daily sessions, which are divided in two sub-sessions. You could say there are 4 sessions. They start very early. Right now, for example, in Europe, it's 7:25 a.m., so they're already having breakfast. In about 35 minutes, they'll be sitting small groups of about 20 people. Again, it's 120 of them who attend these meetings. They'll break up into small 20 to 25-person groups, and they'll be discussing different agenda items in small groups. Then they'll switch groups, and they'll discuss other agenda items while other people who are discussing, you know, agenda item, for example, dealing with cyber terrorism, will be discussing what to do with, you know, future European nationalism. And then at the end of the day, they'll kind of get together as a big group, and they'll work on key agenda items. But again, what's interesting about these meetings is no matter how you look at them, whether it's Bilderberg meeting, whether it's Trilateral Commission, which is, you know, varsity, junior varsity to Bilderberg, or Council on Foreign Relations, which is an American version of Bilderberg. No matter where you look at it, the key word to all these, you know, deliberations is secrecy. And if you kind of look at the world stage from 1 year to the next, you have the, you know, World Economic Forum in Davos in January. You have the G7 meeting in April. Bilderbergers meet in May. Then International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, they have their annual meeting in September. In between, you have regional meetings of the Trilateral Commission, European Commission meetings, and so on and so forth. It's kind of invisible international consensus emerges, and it carries from one meeting to the next. But there's no this, you know, one individual who's leading this meeting. There's no this eminence gris. The consensus becomes the background, for example, to the G7 economic policies. It becomes a background to what the International Monetary Fund uses, what it imposes its adjustment programs on Argentina, for example. And it becomes a background to what the United States president proposes to Congress. And so basically, from the moment that Bilderberg Conference closes, the consensus reached in different areas of discussion at the annual meeting, they're wholeheartedly promoted by these powerful political and commercial interests through the mainstream press, while simultaneously becoming common policy to governing international forces of seemingly different persuasions. And these meetings basically are used to build unity by resolving differences. The people who attend, they all are one world globalists who understand the world in very, very similar ways. Occasionally, you get people invited who may very well be the enemies of Bilderberg, who do not agree with their agenda,
right,
and they're invited to convince them or have them understand that Bilderberg way of doing business is exactly how things should be done. And quite often, people who attended, who had their misgivings before the meeting, after the meeting, openly proclaimed that they would love to be invited back because they were convinced by what they see around them. And needless to say, this is one of the objectives of Bilderberg meetings.
Do they plan wars, Daniel?
Not only do they plan wars, again, wars are great for business because it gives you an opportunity to sell guns and butter to both sides of the equation. One of the key issues this year, aside from the usual things that we're watching around us, such as, you know, Ukraine, disintegrating, which has very much to do with controlling Russia, is again the financial crisis, one of the key elements of the financial crisis. We're about, you know, to have the repeat of 2008 when we had
the crash.
The financial crash, and they're very concerned about
that. Hang on, Daniel. We're going to come back. Let's talk more about that, wars, and we'll take calls on Coast to Coast AM. And we're talking with Daniel Estulin about, of course, the Bilderberg Group this hour. We'll take your calls in a second. By the way, if you want to participate, go to Twitter at our hashtag, hashtag Bilderbergs, and you can tweet your opinion about this guest. So you can do that and also about the group of the Bilderbergs and participate that way. Welcome back to Coast. Daniel Estulin with us. His book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. They are meeting right now in Copenhagen. Daniel, we're talking about how they could start wars or plan these things. And I want to ask you something else. During 2001, during 9/11, is this a stretch to even assume that they may have known about it before it happened?
I think there's very little doubt that they, you know, surely knew about this, because we know from everything, all the evidence out there, all the security shenanigans, all the money is changing place or not changing place, all the bets being put on, the put options being put on the airlines and so on and so forth. Needless to say, these people would be in on it. Beyond that, to actually go and say they talked about this, they had anything to do with planning the 9/11 itself, is, you know, I would never, you know, ever venture to say that. But certainly they had the financial and the insider knowledge to profit from any kind of an operation like 9/11.
How did they generate so much power?
You know, let me give you an example. For example, if we're talking about money, that's needless to say, one of the key issues always is the economy. Over the past 60 years, since its inception, Bilderberg imposed one of the most profound shifts in economic and nation-state policies, the paradigm shift to a post-industrial economy, oil shocks, credit cutoffs, interest rate shocks, forcing the world economy to go to zero and eventually negative growth. And the result of this far-reaching policy or policies today are self-evident. All we need to do is look at the United States and Detroit. It's a poster child for what they're planning to do with the world when you actually move into the future, because, again, the idea of deindustrialization, zero growth, demand destruction, you know, fits like a glove with their plans to deindustrialize the world and reduce the world's population. They want Detroit all over the world, many, many Detroits. And, again, for any sane American, if you look at Detroit, a city which for decades has been, you know, the center of America's industrial technological might. You know, to see it in this calamitous state of actually, you know, bombed out shell, post-apocalyptic shell of something you'd see in a Will Smith movie, I'm Legend, with zombies, but isn't something that, you know, you would expect to see in the actual real-life economy. But this is exactly what we have right now. And again, if you kind of look at what's happening right now on the world stage, especially with economies, especially, you know, with these bubbles. As this speculative bubble in the United States a few years back came to dominate the United States and the world economies, feeding it became paramount. And what you saw this, you know, run up in real estate values to provide wealth, which could be turned into mortgage debt, and then into a wild assortment of securities to be used with lots of leverage to play in the derivatives markets. And, you know, needless to say, this thing eventually exploded. We know as the subprime crisis, but it had nothing to do with subprime. It had to do with the financial system itself. And this is, needless to say, one of the ways that these people are using money to destroy the world economy on purpose. And the listeners have to understand that they need to destroy the world economy, because progress and development, technological development, is directly proportional to population density. So if you're going to have progress, you're going to have more people, more families, more mouths to feed. And if you're the elitists, you don't need more people on the planet Earth, because more people means less food and water for them. So for them to survive, most of us have to die off.
Okay, so, you know, with what happened in 2008, are you saying that, like, because earlier I thought you said that they'd be afraid of it, would they like to see another 2008 happen again?
Actually, if you look at the derivatives bubble right now, it's 25% to 30% larger than anything we had back in the 2008, and this is a scary part of it, because, you know, they're very much openly talking about what's going to happen to the world economy over the next 6 months to 12 months because it's, you know, the derivatives bubble is very, very much on their agenda, and they're very concerned about what's going to happen. And once you make the decision, you know, to create bubbles, especially the derivatives bubble, it basically becomes a pyramid scheme. So what you're doing is you're delinking the financial gains from the real economy, productive economy, which you have to go and to do if you're killing the real economy. But you want to build up the speculative bubble. You have to, you know, divorce it from the reality, and derivatives is a great way to do that. It's like creating a game, you know, a casino table. And derivatives, for people who don't know, although may have heard the word, are basically a side bet on the movements of various things like bonds, the value of bonds, interest rates, currency rates. So you speculate in all these things, and you can bet on how the speculation is going to go. So you can actually bet and say, I think it's going to go up, or I think it's going to go down. So you pile derivatives on top of derivatives on top of derivatives. And a good example of that is the mortgage market, which, you know, everyone is very, very much familiar with, in which you had mortgages which were used to back derivatives, at least theoretically back them. But the notional value of derivatives, the dollar amount of the derivatives that were created, were much more than the value of the mortgages. So you use the mortgages as a fuel to fuel these derivative machines, which then leveraged out we don't know how many times, and ultimately, you know, this whole thing blew out completely, and the economy blew out with it. And this is unfortunately something that we're seeing right now. And this game worked for a while, but it quickly turned nasty when the market seized up. And you have, you know, speculators who found themselves losing, you know, billions of dollars, you know, instantaneously, you know, on these margin calls. And the solution to the blowout adopted by the central banks around the world was to begin to flood the financial markets with liquidity through a series of interest rate cuts and cash injections. And these injections escalated from billions to the tens of billions to the hundreds of billions. As, you know, these people raced to plug the holes caused by the savage deflation of the valuations in the system. And of course, you know, the faster the government pumped in the money, the faster the value of the dollar collapsed, and the faster the global economy will collapse. And this is exactly what these people want. And, you know, people have to understand that this is being done on purpose, because these individuals who control the world's financial strings and the money strings, they understand exactly what they're doing. And by destroying the world's economy, they're not destroying themselves. And that's something that people have to understand, because they already control 90% of the world's wealth and the world, period. You know, but the bailouts that we're seeing and we saw, it was a giant trap, George. Under the guise of saving the economy, they transferred huge amounts of debt from the private hands, from the banks and other powerful interests, to the books of the government, because the economy is continuing to collapse through this period. The debt is absolutely unpayable. There's no way you can pay this debt.
It's impossible. It's impossible.
Exactly, exactly. The real purpose of the bailout is to finish the destruction of the governments. And so in Europe, for example, you see all these negotiations trying to save the debt, and one nation after another, you know, they're falling to corporatist dictatorship. And this is what it's about. It's the idea of creating one world company limited corporations, which will effectively control governments on their behalf around the world. And this is what Bilderberg does at these meetings. They manipulate the cycles. They decide how it's going to be done. And it's all done through consensus, because these are very intricate operations. So everyone has to be on board, and everybody has to be working together. And the media, world media, plays a very significant role in this, which is why some of the key individuals, media individuals such as Martin Wolf from the Financial Times, you know, they're the real stars of these meetings, because through them, all this information gets out into the public.
Let's take some calls. Let's go to Frank in Denver, Colorado, to get things going on the wild card line. Hey, Frank, go ahead.
Hello, Daniel.
Hello, sir.
How do the Bilderbergs justify that 40,000 children starve to death every day?
It's not very difficult to justify, needless to say, not publicly, but, you know, privately. The idea is to reduce the world's population. You see, we're living on a small planet. The Earth is a small planet. There are 7 billion people. We have limited natural resources and an ever-growing population base and ever-decreasing natural resources such as food and water. And if you look at India, for example, that's 1.3 billion people, and they're out of water. You know what I mean? So if you have no water, there's no life in India. So this is one of the ways that they obviously understand and are concerned about the natural resources. So if you can reduce the population any way possible, and needless to say, starvation is one of the great ways, great, quote-unquote, great for them, from their point of view, of reducing the world's population. Because what you're looking at when we're talking about these private organizations, and Bilderberg is not a secret society, as some people, you know, erroneously say. It's a very powerful private organization. What is very true about these powerful organizations, basically it's an empire. When I say an empire, I'm not talking about a king or a queen or the president or the prime minister, you know, sitting on a gold plate. Throne empires are above kings. It's a system of control. It's control of everything by this moneyed elite, by this international system controlled by international bankers. And unfortunately, this is exactly what they want, to reduce the world's population. And, you know, if people are to participate in self-government, and again, eternally grateful to George and, you know, for having these kinds of shows that everybody's listening to, and also to the audience, you know, who tune in and understand, you know, just how important it is to realize that these organizations, they're for real. And, you know, if we, the people, are to participate in self-government, we must participate in the ideas by which society is self-governed. And this, of course, would mean the end of oligarchism and the Rockefellers of this world, you know, the queens and kings of this world. They understand this because nations who foster the creative mental development of their population produce people who will not tolerate oligarchic form of rule indefinitely. Only illiterate, technologically backward population will. In fact, there's very little doubt that illiteracy and technological backwardness are contributing causes for the emergence of this oligarchical rule, which we must break in order to survive as humanity.
Next up, we go to Barbara in Newark, Ohio, east of the Rockies. Barbara, thanks for calling. You're up.
Yes. Something that just intrigues me.
Your phone is... I'm going to put you on hold and see if Tom can get a better line with you, okay? Because I don't want you to lose your personal line. Take it away, Tommy. First-time caller, Fred is in Ferndale, Michigan. Know that town well. Fred, go ahead.
Yeah, the Canary in the Coal Mine near Detroit here, right on the border.
There you are. That's right.
Okay, you know, even the Bible talks about in the last days, there'll be the king of the north, the king of the south. It seems like the Bilderbergers, the one world government people, the new world order people, they got a problem. Vladimir Putin, does he got to go, or what's going to happen here? Are they, the Ukraine like the showdown between north and south, east and west? What's the deal there?
Well, the deal is very simple. The end game in the world, generally speaking, is Russia. It's the biggest country in the world. It's the country with, you know, the greatest concentration of natural resources. Russia has, you know, everything you could possibly want. So in order to control the world politics, you need to be able to take over Russia. And this is one of the reasons, actually, you know, we got into the World War One, and this is one of the key reasons we had World War Two, except that the elite, the oligarchs, who financed Hitler and who financed this drive to destroy the Soviet Union, they failed because 26 million Soviet citizens died, sacrificed their lives, so that we, the people in the world, not only the Russian citizens, could enjoy a better world. They did succeed after the war because their plan was, through a paradigm shift in society, to change the very definition of, you know, from moral rectitude, you know, to this moral destruction of degeneracy. And so in 1991, the Soviet Union fell apart, as did other nations in the Soviet bloc, and then Yugoslavia fell apart in the mid-1990s. But the idea of destruction of the Soviet Union, you know, into smaller nation states such as Lithuania and Ukraine and other countries was one of the ways of weakening the country. And then they almost, you know, they came to the, you know, to the within a hair of succeeding in the late 1990s when they installed their puppet by the name of Yeltsin, who was one of the most corrupt and crookedest politicians in the history, I think, of mankind. And they almost got away, you know, with their plan of destroying Russia until Putin came in, and you know, you literally had your artificial coup d'état where, you know, Putin and the KGB apparatus, they took over the entire structures, key structures of Russia. And today, needless to say, as you said correctly, Putin is the enemy. And it has nothing to do with Ukraine or democracy, because in Ukraine, you know, we're seeing the people who are actually, you know, hold the levers of power. They're the Nazis, the Banderites, the same people who fought side by side, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the Nazis in the Second World War. and who are responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Jews and the Russians and the Pole citizens simply because they were anti-Nazi and because they were fighting, you know, to preserve their nation states and freedom. And so this is where we're at today. And needless to say, we have Kerry's and the Bidens and the Obamas. They know exactly what's going on. And the reason we have this is because most people, you know, when you look at politics, people think of national and foreign policies. But these foreign policies and national policies are run by presidents and prime ministers who have very little real power, because the real power is in the hands of those people who put presidents and prime ministers in their gold-plated seats at the White House or, you know, in Canada, in Ottawa, in the House of Commons. It's these people, the shadow masters, who run the world from behind the scenes. And this is done through global policy. And this global policy affects everything we see on the world stage, which is why what we see in Detroit, what we see in Caracas, Venezuela, we see what's happening in Bangkok, Thailand, what we see in Ukraine, we see all over the world the same individual groups of very powerful people, you know, with their agendas have very little to do with, you know, betterment of mankind, are running these operations from behind the scenes. Unfortunately, and this is one of the key issues that we'll be discussing at this year's Bilderberg Conference, is Obama and company, they miscalculated, because they forced their European partners to impose sanctions on Putin, except that they forgot to lock the back door. The back door is you have Putin reaching an agreement with the Chinese, and it's a nightmare scenario for Bilderberg. China and Russia and now Iran working together to stop their plans.
All right, let's go back to Barbara in Newark, Ohio. Tom says we got a better connection there. Barbara, let's give it a try.
Yes. One thing that just amazes and intrigues me is the name Henry Kissinger that was on the list.
Well, you're right about that. Now, the connection's not that good, but the question, of course, got through. It's about Henry Kissinger.
Well, Henry Kissinger is, you know, one of the earlier members. He was there, I think, from the very beginning. I'm not sure if in 1954, but certainly 1957, 58, he started attending Bilderberg meetings, brought there by David Rockefeller. And you have still some of these, you know, old remnants who are dying off. Like Kissinger just turned 93 yesterday or the day before yesterday. So, you know, thankfully, he doesn't have much more to go. Rockefeller is on his way, you know, out studying for his, you know, for his finals already. He's 100 years old. So again, today's Bilderberger crop of invitees is much less powerful than what we had back in the 1950s and 1960s. But no matter how you look at it, these people are anti-democracy, anti-freedom, anti-nation states. And democracy, that's another key issue which was discussed, George, or will be discussed at this year's conference, is what to do with, you know, European nationalism, because, you know, democracy has indeed gone out of fashion in the European Union. It's been replaced by open bankers' dictatorship through the Treaty of Lisbon, which stealthily replaced the European Constitution, and a move towards creating this European superstate, which later on will be merged with North America and America State. And that's their objective, the creation of one world company, limited corporations with a lot more power than governments anywhere in the world.
We've only got about a minute or so left, Daniel, so I want to wrap things up, and we'll have to have you back for a longer show after this meeting is up. Are you going to sneak in there or not?
No, I'm not. I'm not in Denmark. It simply doesn't make any sense to be there because, you know, once my book came out and once we exposed their plans and the pictures came out and you know, all over the world about what I saw, you know, because I did sneak in on several occasions in the past. And right now, it's impossible to get anywhere near the hotel. It's literally, you know, a live bunker. And if you look at some of the photos out there on the internet, it's a war zone. You can't get anywhere near, you know, within about, you know, 500-600 feet of the hotel, and it doesn't make sense to sneak in. But we certainly get the information from our inside sources, which
yes,
we've developed over the past 20
true.
Years.
That's true. We've got them. Daniel, thank you so much. Next up, crossing the event horizon.